Happy Sabbath, everyone. Hope you all had a good week and have fun weekend plans. Labor Day weekend's always, you know, the ceremonial end of summer. Hopefully it's a good weekend for everybody. Let me check, do a time check here. So I did it again. I stepped in it this week with a coworker this time. This is a coworker that I have had repeated offenses with over the past 3 years. And they did something, applied false blame and lying to one of my staffers. And I shot back. I got involved and stepped in and defended my team member, which I'm not saying that was a bad thing. But I also responded pretty emotionally to it. It was measured, but my heart was retaliatory. My heart was, I'm going to show you what's really happening here. Overall, it ended fine. I had a long discussion with their manager, and we worked some things out. But as Mr. Kemp was saying, these trials, these things that we face on a day-to-day basis are often relationship-based. The Bible is a book about relationships and how to manage difficult situations and people and trials. Let's go to Matthew 5, verse 38. Matthew 5, verse 38, we get some instruction here from Jesus about retaliation, about vengeance. And I find this passage in the Sermon on the Mount one of the most difficult to apply. Matthew 5:38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. We're given several examples of injustice that occur in this passage. Today I'm going to just talk about the three. I'm going to leave verse 42 out of it today. That's a whole bigger topic, I feel. But there's three injustices that are mentioned here. Somebody slapping you on your right cheek, somebody suing you for an asset that you own or have, and then someone forcing you to do something that you don't want to do. You know, an initial read of this, at least my initial read of this, has always been, am I just to be a doormat? Am I just to be weak? What a weak, passive stance I'm supposed to take. Jesus is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, comes riding in on a white horse, and I'm supposed to stand there and get beat up. That's the instruction. That's how I've taken it. And it goes against my, and I believe our, traditional, very, I'll say, American view of Christianity, where we feel threatened with our personal freedoms and rights. We demand self-respect. In order to understand this passage, we have to understand the historic context and the intent of the original law, eye for an eye. I have several, this is maybe going to be a little more technical than my normal sermons, but I think it's important to get the sourcing and the context. And I'll just list them up front. I have several sources for this. MacArthur, Barclay, Bema Discipleship, which pulls on a lot of rabbinic teaching in historic context. But where I want to start, in order for us to fully understand what this passage is meaning, we have to go a little bit earlier in the sermon. Let's go to verse 17 of Matthew 5. Verse 17 of Matthew 5. It says, do not think, this is Jesus speaking again, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. The law, including this eye for an eye law. Christ is saying, don't think I came to destroy this law. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. To fulfill. And that's a principle we have to take into this passage. That is, that Jesus came not only to live in obedience and not to sin, but Jesus also came to demonstrate the law. He came to demonstrate its intent and its purpose, the original intent of it. We often read this teaching as, oh, and then Jesus changed it, or Jesus added to it. He didn't add to anything. He's emphasizing the original intent of the law. The original intent, and he's demonstrating it by his actions. That has not changed from the instructions given to ancient Israel. He's simply revealing what the original intent and the continual intent of the law is, to change a person's heart through obedience, through faithful obedience. We have to start here in order to understand his teaching on retaliation. We know that God is love. That does not change. We know that the law is holy and just and good. That does not change. So we have to remember this. Let's go back to verse 38 and break this down verse by verse. Verse 38, you've heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. What does this mean? This concept shows up actually three times in Levitical law, or I should say Mosaic law. It's tossed throughout Exodus, Leviticus, and I think Deuteronomy. We won't go to there. You can go there on your own if you're curious about it. But it shows up not only in the biblical teaching, it shows up in historic documents. Hammurabi's code, for example, has the very same principle, eye for an eye. We know it as tit for tat. It's actually an old English term, meaning blow for blow. But this is a very common ancient teaching that would have been very common to this audience to understand it, not only from the Israelite perspective, but from just living in any form of government. Very common teaching. The Greek term was actually the lex talionis. Lex talionis. You might look that up if you're curious about it. We view it today as a way of administering retaliation often. You take my tooth, I'm going to take your tooth. You hit me, I'm going to hit you. You steal, I'm going to steal. But that was not the intent of the law. It never was the intent of the law. This eye for an eye does three things. It's supposed to demonstrate three things. The first one is it deliberately limits vengeance. It's actually designed to administer mercy. If someone punches you and your tooth falls out, you can't take five of their teeth out. It limits what can you or the judge or whoever's administering that judgment can actually do against another person. It actually is promotion of mercy. There was to be no redemptive violence here. No redemptive violence. And the context isn't just physical harm or stealing or taking someone's physical assets or something. If you look at the Old Testament verses, the context is all over the place. This was a principle. You can't retaliate more than what somebody did to you, because that produces a cycle of vengeance and hatred. We see this happening. The biggest thing happening here on the global scale is probably the Israel-Palestine thing. Why has that gone on for so many decades? It's because the retaliation, the vengeance, that's one of the many, many reasons, it's a very complex situation. But the retaliation in this idea of vengeance, and I've got to get back and I got to hit harder. God says, no, we can't hit harder. The judgment is not to hit harder. So that's the first kind of point about this. The second one is it was never intended to be literal. It was never literal. God is not into mutilation. It's actually unjust to take out someone's good eye because somebody else lost an eye. It's actually an unjust thing for that person. It's no more literal than Christ saying, cut off your hand if it causes you to sin. It's no more literal than that. Different contexts, as I said earlier in the scripture, the Old Testament passages, reveal that the principle is a guide for judgment. It's a guide for judgment. It's not intended to be taken literally. The third thing about this, before we get into these examples, is the principle is about administering justice. Administering justice. The context is always about when a trial or when an issue goes before a judge. Goes before a judge or goes before somebody with authority. Wasn't necessarily meant to be a person-to-person thing, although it could be. But it was supposed to have witnesses, in other words. You were supposed to have other people around administering this. I want to read a section from Barclay, because I think we view some of these things, at least I do, and we think, oh, that's back then, that doesn't apply to us today, or that context really doesn't feed into the modern world that we live in. I just want to read a section here. Again, these were disputes that went before a jury or a judge in ancient Israel. It says, the Jewish jurists argued rightly that to carry it out literally, meaning to carry eye for an eye out literally, might be in fact a reverse of justice because it might involve the displacement of a good eye or a good tooth or a bad eye for a bad tooth. Let's go on here. If a man has injured another, he is liable on five counts. This is how they used to do it. Five counts. For injury, for pain, for healing, for loss of time, and for indignity suffered. So what they do is they take those five counts, and it goes on to explain all this, takes these five counts and it assigns a monetary value to those things. So if you injure someone and they can't work, you must then pay eye for eye for that person's livelihood until they are able to go back to work. If you humiliate them through something, you had to therefore put a monetary value on that and pay that back for their humiliation, for their reputational harm that you caused. If they have medical bills, you then had to pay those medical bills, but not a dime more. You pay it eye for eye. This wasn't a lawsuit where you, in reality, you had $700,000 worth of damage and the court awards you $15 million worth of damage to avoid some bad PR for a company or something. This is not, that's not administering justice. This law is about administering justice. And there's a principle here of eye for eye and tooth for tooth. You with me? Let's go on. Let's explore these examples, because this is where the rubber meets the road. This is real Christian living right here. This is when somebody accuses your team member and lies and places blame and you get all upset about it and figure out, how do I deal with this situation when I've been dealing with it for 3 years and it's not getting resolved? Maybe I shared too much on that front. Okay. One point I want to bring out. As I said earlier, you look at these passages, or I look at this passage, and I sometimes think, oh, I got to be so passive and weak. I just need to be a doormat. When we bring it into the context of administering justice, it actually creates a much more active approach. A much more active approach. I believe Jesus is trying to prevent us from going into two ditches. One is open retaliation. I'm going to blow you to smithereens for something you did. And the other one is being a doormat. I'm going to stand here and take abuse. Neither one is Christian living. He's guiding us towards something that's more in the middle, but also more in line with his character and intent for human relationships. And as we're all made in God's image, godly relationships. Let's start with the first one. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Okay. Most commentaries point out that in the first century, in ancient cultures, people used their right hand. This was the people hand. You could touch people, you could eat with this hand, whatever. And the left hand was for other things, we'll put it. So if you're sitting next to somebody, look at them. How are you gonna slap, look at them, go ahead, it's fine. How are you gonna slap them on the right hand, on the right cheek, if you're using only your right hand? If you use the palm, you're gonna hit what? The left hand, or the left cheek. You have to use the back of your right hand to get a good slap in on somebody, right? You have to use the back of your right hand. That's very important. These details, the right cheek, this is very important. Because if someone was to hit you with the back of their right hand, I don't see anybody hitting each other, that's good. If they're gonna hit you with the back of their right hand, that was reserved for the lowest, most demeaning, reserved for animals. You would never hit somebody with the back of your right hand. And yet, the instruction is, if someone hits you on your right cheek with the implication that it's with the back of their right hand, what are you supposed to do in that situation? They've just demeaned you. They've treated you like an animal. They've told you you are not only worthy of hitting, you're not even human. You don't have any dignity. But we're given an instruction here to turn the other cheek. Note that we're not given the instruction to hit back, first off, which is really interesting. Let's leave it there. I don't even know how to. Again, I process through these things as I learn about them more. But then we're told to turn the other cheek. We see this as passive. We see it as, all right, well, we're just welcoming another hit. Is he supposed to hit me with his left hand now, the dirty hand? Is that what he's asking him to do? It's actually a very interesting approach. When someone hits you with the back of their right hand on the right cheek, and you turn and you say, all right, take a shot at the left cheek, what you're asking them to do is hit you with the palm of their right hand. And what that's telling them is, treat me with respect. Treat me with dignity. I am not an animal. You are not an animal. If we're gonna go toe-to-toe on something, let's go toe-to-toe on something as equals. So what you're doing, what the teaching is that Christ is trying to get across here, is for Christians, for people who follow him, to introduce dignity to a conflict. To introduce dignity to a conflict. Especially when it's not present. When someone treats you as dirt on the ground, we are not to treat them as dirt on the ground. We're actually supposed to rise up and remind them that we are fellow humans. You know, dust yourself off. Okay, let's try this again. Let's try this again. Does that mean they're going to change? No, they might hit you back of the hand right up, right again. We can't stop that. We can maybe defend ourselves a little more as we wait for it. But for them to attack who you are as a child of God and made in the image of God, and for them to treat you like that, that's when it's actually not a passive stance at all. It's saying, let's try this again. And you give them an opportunity to recognize the injustice. This is peacemaking. This is trying to bring someone in to the way of God when they don't want to be in on the way of God. And they're very likely not going to take the bait. They're very likely not going to reevaluate and say, okay, let's try this again. But that's not the teaching. The teaching is, you need to do this. We need to stand up and do this. And it takes a lot of self-control. It takes a lot of internal processing But when we have a chance to introduce dignity into a dispute, we should take it. We should take it. And that often depends on how we react to something. Don't treat me like an animal, treat me like a human. Let's go on. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let them have your cloak also. Actually, you know, going back to the first one, Mr. Kemp was talking about Paul. Let's go to that, actually. Paul, in Acts 16, I was reading it when he was talking about it, and it's a good example of Paul introducing dignity in his situation. Acts 16, verse 37, Paul says to them, so they get, you know, they get released, and then they all, the Roman authorities decide to go ahead and release them, but they don't want anybody to know the injustice that they did. They're trying to hide behind the injustice. And part of what we're doing, part of what Christ is teaching here is bring the injustice out. Point out the injustice going on here. So Paul does this in verse 37. Paul said to them, they've beaten us only openly, uncondemned Romans, and have thrown us into prison. He's saying this is unjust what they've done to us. And now they want to put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and get us out. Is Paul punching back? No. But he is turning the other cheek and say, if this is how you've treated me, we're going to keep this open. You're the one who opened it. We're going to keep it open and expose the injustice that was done. Because I'm a fellow human. We have to solve this together. We have to work through this together. I thought it was an interesting example he brought up. All right, number 2. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let them have your cloak also. A better translation describes the tunic as an inner garment and the cloak as an outer garment. Even the poorest person would have several inner garments. Consider this underwear, okay? In a more like a sack setting here. We don't wear these today. Well, there actually are some Christians that do this, but anyway, it's an inner garment, and then we'd have a covering or a coat or an overgarment. That coat would not only provide protection, usually only had one of those because they were more expensive, significantly more expensive, made of a better material, and they were protective. They protected you from the elements, they kept you warm. At night, they were even your blanket. They were even your blanket. In Exodus 22, verse 26 and 27, actually forbids the taking of a person's cloak. Don't take their outer garment. That's their warmth. That's their protection. Don't do it. So again, if someone's suing you for this cheap inner garment, attacking your assets, attacking your physical items, your livelihood maybe even, the instruction is actually to give them both garments. We're to give them our inner garment. Play this out in a courtroom. Give them your inner garment, okay, and then you give them your outer garment, okay. What are you left standing in? Absolutely nothing. You are naked. What is the teaching here? Are we supposed to strip down naked when someone wants to take something of ours that we're wearing? What is the teaching here? Like I said, the law says you can't take someone's outer garment. The Levitical law said you can't take someone's outer garment. But our response, what Jesus is adding to this is, I shouldn't say adding, what the intent was, the original intent, is that when someone wants to take something that's relatively cheap and inexpensive, or let's just call it in a broader sense, a petty disagreement. If it's a petty disagreement, let's assign a monetary value. This thing's worth $10, but my outer cloak is worth $10,000. Someone's after something that's $10, Show the injustice by giving him everything you got. Show the injustice of that person taking you to court over $10. Bring it out. Bring out the injustice that you see. That their initial claim is, lack of a better word, silly. Your initial claim is silly. It's not founded. You don't need my $10 tunic. Here, take a $10,000 cloak. Are you satisfied now? I probably shouldn't add that last part. That's not a great attitude. But that's what I would add. Satisfied now? As Christians, we understand that petty matters are unfruitful. And they're not to be getting us involved in. We shouldn't get involved in them. They're petty. In this case, it's a petty legal matter. I should use a different word. Our pastor is called Gary Petty. I should use a different word. But you know what I'm saying. They're small matters. They're unfruitful. They're not becoming of us as God's children. We also understand the broader context that God owns everything. He owns it all. This is tough stuff when you get down to it, if you try to apply it in real life. The third one I want to talk about, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with them two. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him two. In the Roman world, there was a principle, I'm going to try to pronounce it, called agagurian, which was to compel someone as a courier or a service to the government. This is actually what happens to Simon the Cyrene when he has to carry Jesus' cross through the streets. He's tapped on the shoulder by a Roman authority and says, carry this. And it was not a privilege to do that. It was a service. It was the government saying, you're up, you got to do this now. And it was demeaning. It was often very demeaning to be asked to do this. But at any point, if we lived in ancient Rome, a Roman soldier or authority could tap you on the shoulder and say, I need you to carry my equipment for me. I need you to carry some food for me. Here's my unmentionable bag. You need to carry that for me. And you had to stop what you were doing and be a courier. There was one limit to this. You could only do it for a mile. Then they were violating the law, and they could get in trouble for that. So the teaching that Jesus brings out is that we are to go 2 miles with this. So again, play the scenario out. You got a bunch of stuff on your back. They've interrupted your day, asked you to carry something that you didn't want to carry, probably treated you pretty poorly. And you're at the 1 mile mark, and they know they need to make you stop, and they're going to find somebody else to take it the rest of the mile. And you just gear up, and you keep walking. How is that going to make that person feel? It's going to be a little awkward, I would think. They'd be like, I can get in trouble for this. Or, what are you doing? This isn't right. Again, you're causing that person to reflect on the injustice that they've inflicted on you. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have treated you so poorly for the past mile. Is this going to change their behavior? Who knows? God knows. Our instruction is to bring it to light. To bring it to light. To use a more modern example, if a restaurant manager wants you to bus his or her dirty table because they're too lazy to do it, then you do it. And you not only do that, you bust the whole section. And maybe, just maybe, they'll pause and be like, well, that was interesting. And they'll probably take advantage of it. Very likely. I mean, I see that in my own career. They'll take advantage of it. But our job is to keep busting the tables. Keep busting the tables. Because with every swipe of the hand, we're gently and lovingly actually pointing out the injustice being done. Whether they realize it or not, God sees it. There's also kind of a thought here of doing your work with cheer. You know, you can do this, you can walk begrudgingly for a mile. And, oh, I can't believe they're making me do this. So heavy. Or you can cheerfully serve for 2 miles. Heap fires of coal on their head. That's not passive. It's very active. It's very active. I think of examples of Joseph in all of his slavery. He did this really well. Rebecca, when she brought the water to the camels, you read that story, she's going up and down a well with, it's probably 70 feet deep, over and over and over again, and she's got a smile on her face and she's happy. It's a principle of Christian living. These examples and instructions require us to be active. Let's go to a couple other verses here. One thing before we turn to these, the last final verses here. There's in verse 39 of this passage, it tells us, I tell you not to resist an evil person. That also seems very counter to my thinking. Because when someone is going to sue me or slap me or force me into doing something, I want to resist that evil person. But maybe God wants to use us as an opportunity to teach them something, whether they recognize it or not, whether they have a heart for it or not. But it's an opportunity that we should not resist an evil person. Evil's evil. It's all over. I'm not saying, there's nowhere in here that says you're going to win in these situations. Nowhere in here does it say we're going to win. But godly character isn't about winning all the time. Let's go to 1 Peter 2. Wrap up with a couple larger passages that point these principles out. 1 Peter 2. Verse 15. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Get it to where they can't possibly say anything against you. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, or a cloak to promote evil. But as bondservants of God, you know, this, we're not to come out swinging. It says, don't punch back, turn the other cheek. Drop down, oh no, keep going. Verse 17, honor all people. Like I said, this brings dignity into situations. And God tells us to honor all people. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Drop down to verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but the harsh. This is commendable. Because of our conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. What credit is it when you are beaten for your faults if you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer and you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow his steps, who committed no sin nor is deceit found in his mouth. In verse 23, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return, He didn't give space for vengeance. He didn't retaliate when he suffered. He did not threaten. But he committed himself to him who judges rightly. That's why the intent of the law is important. He committed himself to justice. He's pointing out justice and pointing the person towards a just life, just living. An eye for an eye is about administering mercy and justice. And he's going back to this principle here, Peter is, to say when Christ lived this out, which was not pleasant, by the way, if we think it's going to be pleasant, we're doing it wrong. This is not easy stuff. But that he might live, that he committed himself to him who judges rightly. It's going back to judgment. Going back to judgment. Romans 12. This will be our last passage. Romans 12, 14. You probably thought I was going to go here, and you were correct. Romans 12. Verse 14, this is very counter to our human nature. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Bless and do not curse. We're not to only bless those who we get along with or who we like. The Christian response is different. Christianity is different than the world. If we're blending with the world, if we're getting involved in petty arguments and retaliation and things like that, we're not living the Christian life. I'm speaking to myself because I did it this week. We're not living the Christian life. It's different. Drop down to verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. Point them to the good. Point them to what is just. If it's possible, as much depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. I always have a visual in my head here of giving place to wrath. Actually, you know, if you're a writer or a journaler, writing the, I can't stand this, and actually putting it in a place and say, that's where my wrath lies. God, take care of that. Your vengeance is yours. You take care of that thing that I'm dealing with here. Give place to wrath. Do not, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. Go the extra mile. Give him the cloak. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Doesn't mean they're going to change. But it does mean you're going to show them a little bit about the character of God. Whether they ever tell you that or not. In verse 21, do not be overcome by evil. Don't play this game. Don't play this game. But overcome evil with good. An eye for an eye principle is to prevent us from playing the game of vengeance and retaliation, perpetual hatred towards our neighbor. We are to put a stop to that. We as Christians are to put a stop to that. It's not, there's two parties here, or more than one party here. Our behavior is to try to put a stop to that. We can't always control what the other person's going to do. But if we're going to try, I'm going to follow what Jesus tells me to do. I'm going to start with this and see if that works. Rather than playing this game of vengeance, we're to expose injustice through our conduct. We're to pursue positive actions that invite reconciliation and peacemaking. When we do these things, we will stand out as different. We will stand out as disciples of Christ. Because God is different. His ways are different. This passage here is the hard, hard work of Christian living.